Hello, and welcome to the Bribe 59 Anti-Abuse Working Group session. I might move this slightly over this way so I'm not kind of standing at a really awkward angle. Thank you all for coming this afternoon. I will try not to, you know, create too long a time gap between now and you being able to get ready for the dinner this evening, for that would be a truly terrible thing. We have few kind of open discussion bits and a few presentations for you this afternoon, and hopefully there should be some interesting conversation generated out of it. First of all, I'm going to say thank you to the Ripe NCC staff who are doing Jabber and Scribe activities and tech activities, without whom I would be trying to be in four places at once, and our wonderful stenographers, without whom I would try for months afterwards to remember the really interesting things you said. One addition, Ian Meikle from Nominet has been added into the agenda at the last moment because he didn't run away from me fast enough with an interesting presentation about domain locks for phishing reasons, and he'll talk all about that. So the minutes from Ripe 58 were circulated. Oh, sorry, the one other thing I absolutely forgot was apologies from my co-chair, Richard Cox. He was all planning to be here this week, but sadly he fell ill at the last moment, and so he won't be joining us. So he sends his apologies on that and hopes to see you all in Prague for Ripe 60. Minutes from Ripe 58 were circulated. I don't think there are any comments on them, and unless somebody says anything now, I'm going to consider them to be approved, entered, etc., etc. Nope. Excellent. So, part one, which I think is me doing some talking. The recent list discussion on abuse contacts. Now, we're going to touch on the AbuseX and the IRT object items a little later. But there was an amount of conversation, and there was an amount of conversation elsewhere about methods of people contacting ISPs for abuse reasons. And I have my own opinions on this, but now is not the place where I get to necessarily shout them from the hills. So I was wondering if there was anyone in the room who had any opinions on some of the more recent methods we've seen of talking about abuse and ISPs being contacted about abuse issues. I'm not specifically talking about the methods used by AbuseX and the notion of sending an email for every single incident they come across, but I am certainly alluding to methods of that kind. The ISP for whom I work, which is HENET, the Irish NREN, sends out a very small amount of spam, and we stop it very quickly. The odd machine is owned and some spam gets sent out, but on a bad day we might get 30 emails from AbuseX. I'm guessing there's ISPs out there who get substantially more, far larger number of contacts regarding abuse, and I'm wondering if anyone in the room has any opinions on that, anyone in the room has any experiences, or indeed any suggestions on how better people might suggest such things. Sadly, yes, Marco, the microphones are on either side of the room, so there's nothing in the middle.
It's Marco from Maxwell. Just as an opinion, I'm one of the co-authors and people behind the abuse mailbox attribute, which was introduced a couple of years ago. And I do notice there's again an increase in people actually contacting everybody there. And from what I've seen currently, it seems that they're actually looking for admin contacts in the organization attribute at the moment. And do other people experience that as well? Because, again, I guess this keeps on coming down to educate, and put big signs up somewhere at the Ripe website. Maybe use the Ripe Labs interface to create some tutorials on how to actually get, how to use the right database to get to the correct context. But I see it slipping again. When we actually changed database behavior to exclude email addresses from standard queries and introduced the abuse mailbox attribute next to IRT, things got a lot better, but recently it's been slipping away again.
Sorry.
Well, in fact, I had something to say back the way to abuse 6, but even this one, I am on the side which...
Can you just say your name and who you're from?
Pavel Kacha, CESNET CERTS, Czech CERT team. I'm also, I'm on both sides. I'm also on the side which generates the mail, which reaches the abuse mailboxes. And we always try to use the right abuse mailboxes, but we also have to take into consideration that we sometimes have bad experiences with some of the networks, or that some contact mailboxes which look perfectly valid are in fact not. You get a response from mail server that mailbox doesn't work or so. So you have to escalate and try another means.
Right, but your default first action is to
use the right ones, of course. Of course.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. There's I suppose the additional question there is, I mean, we have the abuse mailbox in the object, and it's there. I suppose there is a question as to what level of checking or what level of I suppose even sanction can be put in place if that address doesn't work. But that's a very much more complicated,
Of
thing.
Course.
Right. Yeah. From my response, I think we went through this discussion a couple of times. Indeed, also with during the abuse mailbox attribute, and like you said, there's actually not much what we can do. We have some people showing up at putting objects into the database. How can we check that's valid? Yeah, of course we can try to, at the moment you introduce the object, you can actually like try to resolve the domain name, contact the mail server, see if it's actually responding with the 200 okay. But it will probably take a lot of work actually doing that, those kind of checks if you enter objects in the database. B, it will make your database perfectly slow. C, I've seen occasions where those checks simply fail, so you would never get to update your object. And even if we do check on the insertion, you have to basically get back every hour to see if that address is still valid. So yeah, what do you do? We can take it out again, but do we take out all points of contact from the database then? Or do we simply drop the database object at all? What should the sanction be if it becomes invalid? That's the main part. And it's technically, of course, you can run checks every once in a while, but what would the sanction would be if it turns out not to be valid? And maybe it's a temporary error, just in the mail server that's not responding or misconfigured for like an hour or so, and by the time we do the check, and we'll take away all the objects. It's I don't see what we can actually do from that perspective.
Well, in fact, you can't. I didn't want to say that you did, that it's your fault. It's in fact the wild world.
Sorry, Wilfried?
Yeah, Wilfried Böber here. I am seeing two developments recently. One of them being that it seems to become fashionable to install some sort of automatic tools which tie into intrusion detection or log scanner or whatever. And for each and every line or each and every incident, that machinery creates an individual complaint. The natural reaction on the receiving end is just configure the mail disposal mechanism and just throw them away, because it's just another form of spam. It's actually, if you get that from too many sources at the same time, it's actually sort of a denial of service attack. That's sort of one observation. I had that just recently. And that leads me to the other thing, like some parties, not naming any particular one, some parties seem to be of the opinion that it is appropriate to do some sort of search towards the responsibility root of a structured whatever, and then claim that those parties responsible for those resources actually prefer receiving an individual notification. I still have to find a single organization which agrees to that claim and which sort of supports that assertion. That's one of the reasons why I ask you to put this onto the mailing list, because I really want to get a feeling what the reality in the world out there is and what is just a view of a particular action. A couple of weeks ago, I have been at a security forum in Tallinn. I was asking more or less the same question there during a discussion, and the answer there was everybody shaking their heads and said, no, that's not the way to go. So I'm looking at this opportunity and at this community to ask that question once again. Is there anyone who agrees sort of with that model of fighting abuse that you find the most detached, the most remote entity up some nutrition tree to the root and try to start complaining there and hope that this entity does some magic to resolve the issue? So I'd really would like to see some show of hands or...
Yeah, well, that was actually, I mean, that was one of the follow-up things. Okay, that's. I'm going to ask a couple of questions in a minute, but sorry, did you, was another point? Sorry, yes. Gentleman there.
Lance Wright, Chocolate Redhead. What we've actually found as far as dealing with spam, don't get me wrong, we're looking at technology and maybe we're looking in the wrong direction. We're trying basically to build a better mousetrap. The reality is why are people sending spam? And if you deal with the reason, it's because they make money doing it. If you can deal with the reason, you deal with the spam. I actually work with a number of companies that actually have solutions that literally are a box. It's a community-based system. If you find a piece of spam, you mark it. It tells everybody else a part of that community. Because if it's not relevant to you, it's probably not going to be relevant to someone else. You're not going to be getting somebody else's email address or anything on anybody else's email address. But the idea being, it actually sends, it finds where it's come from, it sends it back where it's come from, and it actually deals with spam on the financial level, which basically demotivates people, and we find that they leave us alone.
And how big a community, how big an organization are we talking about? What kind of number of mailboxes are?
Number of mailboxes in the United Kingdom, you're probably looking at about 157,000 presently, and we get very little spam now.
Mm-hmm. Did you? Sorry, did I mention you send it back where it's coming from?
Yes. That,
well, yes. How do you verify where it's coming from? Because in 99% of the occasions, the envelope prompts are actually fake.
That is proprietary information. But if you're glad to sign, you know, an NDA, I'm glad to discuss it with you.
Okay.
It's wonderful, these community meetings.
Sorry, do you have another point you wanted to make?
I'm just waiting if the discussion goes back to the starting point.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. So, I suppose there's a number of questions now. As Marco said, there's very little way of, I think, of saying you have entered an email address, therefore, it must always be valid in perpetuity. I know I can't think of a way of testing that, and I'm fairly sure if the Ripe NCC had thought of one, they would have mentioned. So I suppose the question is, one of the questions in the room is it appropriate? Or would you feel it's part of your natural spam fighting reaction that if the abuse contact that's listed in the database bounces or times out or whatever, that you would then go searching for other admin contacts? Or do people feel that they'll make a default decision that the abuse contact is less likely to be real and therefore go for an admin or a billing contact or otherwise? I just, before you make your point, Marco, I'm just wondering, so is there anyone in the room who feels that they would go automatically to the admin contact and just not bother with the abuse contact at any point because they feel it may not be valid or otherwise?
depends on the spam.
Sorry, okay. It's just it's being cast. So if you don't speak at it, go ahead, Todd, please.
It depends on the spam. Because in the early days, the fact of the matter is, most people sending this out, unless it's malicious, they want to sell you something. So ultimately, you go back because they want you to buy something from them. You deal with that source because the person that's dealing with the technology will not basically take any responsibility. They're just saying, I'm doing my job, we're offering a service. You go back to the people that are actually looking to profit from it, you get a lot more response.
Okay, I mean, I'm not standing here with a with a fund of answers, so I'm looking for feedback for recording and for further discussion. Marco, do you have?
I think it's clear that everybody, more or less in this room, kind of like behaves itself and actually look for abuse contacts. And in fact, if that abuse contact or any other associated address is bouncing, then you start contacting the admin or tech contacts in that object. But that's a sensible thing to do. But I personally, and I have to deal with these guys, like Wilfried already mentioned, it's almost as annoying as spam, because usually the spam gets filtered and the complaints don't. So that's the main point here. And as soon as more and more people actually don't take the appropriate stuff and simply by default send abuse contacts, well, good luck, you're filtered also.
So, and that leads into, I mean, that's a fair enough point. I mean, that leads into...
And it actually goes on beyond that, because where do you go next if everybody starts filtering admin contacts?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, the next question is, as Wilfried said, is there anyone who feels that the way they should go about addressing these things is to go to the highest point of registration and start talking there? Or would people normally do what they should be doing, in my opinion, which is going to the most accurate object and contact from there? Mm-hmm. No? Okay, so again, the same as what we've seen elsewhere from that point of view.
I guess it's a simple case of preaching for the choir, and it's actually
And absolutely, and I'm again, it's a case of trying to figure out what is normal.
Maybe you should ask the question tomorrow in the plenary.
Maybe I should.
Audience there.
Sorry, I know you said go back to the beginning. I'm not sure if I've addressed what or have referenced back again.
I think it all started with that. Company which named cannot be said.
Well, okay. I mean, this is the thing. The third question is: are there people in the room who operate whatever size of abuse desk who think yes, mass mails based on one per incident or a high volume per incident work well for you, that you will get an amount of abuse mail, hopefully to the right contacts, obviously, and concomitant to the amount of spam that's been sent out? Or would you prefer single mails, single points? So is there anyone who looks at their, and I'm going to say it again, and I don't mean to kind of drag it through again, but anyone who looks at the emails they likely get from Abuse6 and goes, that's exactly the way I want to receive these mails, and that's awesome for me?
Well, absolutely no.
Well, okay, that's fair enough. So, so you'd prefer individual?
The behavior which most of the CSER teams in community use, and most of other teams who complain in some way, they just aggregate the complaints in some way. Yes, it is some more of the work, but in fact, if you take each and every spam and generate a complaint, then you, by definition, generate spam too.
Yeah, that's a fair enough comment. Absolutely.
It's and you are creating one more of collateral damage.
So
when you steal my watches, okay, I think it might be you. So I go and steal your Parker pen. It's not okay. It might seem that now we're even, but we both committed a crime.
No, that's thank you for those comments. So, I think they're the questions that I wanted to ask now, and I wanted to get a feel for. So, I'm kind of inclined. I know I have sanctions written up there, and I think that's something I'm going to go back to at a slightly later date in the agenda. Because there's been a bunch of discussion on that already this week, and about what the community, what the NTC or otherwise can do in the cases of network abuse. So I'm going to leave that a little later in the agenda. So unless there's any other recent list discussion or otherwise items that anyone wants to raise, we shall move on to our first presentation, which is from Marco. So he gets to have to keep on standing up. But he gets to use this microphone, and I will step away from the podium.
Okay. Well, yeah. I introduced myself already. I'm Marco. I work for a company called AccessRoyal, and you may have known me as the IP6 guy. Security is not really a part of my job, although I am involved, as I said, sometimes even involuntary, because I am an admin contact for the LIR we run. Brian asked me, because I'm actually one of the few people involved in this and also present here to do a small presentation on this. It's botnet confident. These are disclaimer, as I'm not into this subject totally, these are not my slides, and this is not my spelling mistake. In fact, it is Dutch. We are a weird bunch of people putting ends everywhere. So what is this? Well, it's an effort to cooperate on abuse handling, focus on botnets in particular. The initiative was done by a couple of major Dutch ISPs and Opta, which is the Dutch telecoms regulator. And now 14 ISPs have joined this initiative, and these are the participants. Now you might get smart and say, like, these are not 14 ISPs, because some of them actually are brands of the other. LS and BBNet are part of the same company. Obviously, KPN, AccessRoyal, Hetnet, and Telfort are one company. But if you do the math, this is KPN serves about 2.5 million customers. I think Ziggo has 1.8. UPC has about 1 million. Roughly, this boils down to about 6 or 7 million broadband connections in the Dutch market, which is, I think, about 75, almost 80% of the residential connections in the Netherlands are part of this group of people, are actually in the market share. So that's quite well covered, even with only 14 people. Why do we do this? That's the main question asked, and I've also seen this going around on Nanog lately. And abuse fighting obviously is necessary. It's about cleaning our own mess. Our customers misbehave, we have to clean up for them. It's a natural thing, we're good citizens. Other major part is it's proactive. We better do it ourselves before some regulator steps up and makes legislation, because usually what happens is that the legislator gets it almost right and miss out on like some tiny points. And third and major part, it's actually the media attention. It creates awareness. People will have to understand that if that browser comes up saying, like, MIME type evil / zombie isn't recognized, do you wish to download the plugin? And click on yes. No, don't. And if you do, it will have consequences. We will take down your internet connection until you solve your problem and actually get that stuff off your computer again. So that's one of the primary reasons there. Get the word out there that there's something about actually like being a responsible citizen when you connect to the internet. So how are we going to do this? Well, the ISPs will filter and block infected customers, and the ISPs will actually share knowledge and inform each other if you notice that some PC in the other guy's network is part of a zombie network. This is completely natural behavior. Yeah, you think that you're here in the anti-abuse working group and UBIF. And in fact, for us, this has been reality for years and years. If we do get a complaint, we simply, and it's documented in a proper way, push the button, customer is automatically creating a ticket, customer is being mailed, and put in a little sandbox where he can't get out until he fixes his problem. For some of the other people, this is less natural. They don't have those mechanisms in place. They actually have to react by hand and find a way to stop this. And since that's costing money, maybe they're only doing it if the complaints insist. And that's so, it seems totally natural, but still some people have to learn this and have to be taken by the hand to go there and actually tell them what to do and how to do it and actually respond to those complaints. Sharing knowledge. Yeah, you send out abuse complaints, but yeah, there's something to it. We want it more or less documented. There's some legal threat if we just shut you down and we have no proof whatsoever, then it's legal liability for us. And some people do share that information, but it's something like, yeah, people coming around there, you have to build up that trust that if somebody comes to you and say like, hey, this machine is part of a botnet, that we actually trust them to be right and take action upon it. So, well, the when? Lately, there's been quite some press on Nanoch. Well, actually, the pact was signed in July already. Major press coverage was done in August, so Nanoch is a bit late. The agreement is that filtering should be operational by January 2010. And yeah, the exchange of knowledge and info. Yeah, it's a bit strange because obviously when we start filtering, we're already exchanging information, but there is some symposium planned in February. We're actually like talking about the subject and what things encounter and stuff that needs to be covered. Like I said, I'm not the one behind this all, so if you have any questions, the pact is managed by ESP, and if you want more contact, this is the email address of my colleague who is happily answering your questions from his office in Amsterdam. So that's it. Thank you. Any further questions? I might be able to answer them.
Thank you very much. Are there any nice, easy questions for Marco? No? Nothing at all? Okay. Thank you very much. Now, without going all the way back up to my agenda, I am going to ask Ian, and sorry for not introducing you properly, Marco. I had a desperate need for a glass of water at that point in time. Ian Meikle from Nominet, who I grabbed even more recently than I grabbed Marco. Marco got grabbed on Monday and had many days' notice. Ian got grabbed yesterday when he foolishly told me he had been talking to people about the phishing lock project that Nominet had in place. And then I asked him what he was doing around 4 o'clock this afternoon. He got excited for a moment and then realized it was my working group. So without going any further into that, Ian is going to talk about his phishing lock project.
Okay. As Brian said, this is a rehash of a talk that I gave at CenterTech on Sunday. I've extended it a little bit because CenterTech is an audience of people who work for country code top-level domain name registries, and I can't assume that you're that, so for some of you it might be a little bit pedestrian, but anyway, here we go. Just a little bit of background. Phishing lock itself is it's intended to be a tool that can be used to take domain names involved in phishing off the internet. So that'll become clear in a little while. So what I'm going to talk about, like I said, I'll give a short introduction about Nominet, why we've done started this project, a little bit about how we've done it, and some talk about how it's been used, the sort of scale of use so far, the potential for misuse and what we do about that, and where we're going to take it going further. So Nominet, we're the .uk domain name registry. At present, we've got just short of 8 million domain names. I expect we'll go over 8 million this month. And we operate what's called a thick registry model. So what that means is, besides storing the technical information about domain names, which allows them to be looked up in DNS or some details in Whois, we store the social information. So we store the details about the people who have the domains. And that's important because the phishing lock itself can operate on both a domain and on an account. So that's the an account is, it can be a registrant, it can be the people who are registering domain names. So we have two registration interfaces. So this is used by what we call registrars, who are usually ISPs, to register domain names on behalf of registrants. They use either an XML-based interface, which uses an open standard protocol called EPP. This is meant as a common interface across registrars between different domain name registries. There's another option, another interface, which is uses PGP signed email. Both of them allow a common set of operations, and both have input into a single registry. And an important thing to note, and this I missed out on my presentation on Sunday and led to a lot of confusion, is that registrars can only modify their own domains. You can't use this phishing lock on somebody else's domains. It's only ones that you have you've registered on behalf of your registrants. Domains can exist in effectively three states. They can be live, either registered, they're paid for, they're in the zone file. They can be suspended, or they can be cancelled. Now, suspension traditionally was a phase between registration and cancellation once the renewal period of a domain had expired. Now, for our domains, the renewal period is 2 years. So if you, after the two-year registration period, if the renewal has not been paid for, they get put into a kind of suspended state where they're not available to be registered by anybody else, but they're not included in DNS either. So they drop off the internet, but if you're the legitimate owner, you can renew them and they'll go back in before anybody else gets a chance to grab them. If they're not renewed during the suspended phase, they go in, they're cancelled, and then they're available for anybody else to register. And what the phishing lock does effectively is it suspends a domain. It holds it in place so that it can't be visible in DNS. It's not visible in DNS, and it can't be registered by anybody else. It can also be used to lock accounts. So if we get a report about somebody who is consistently registering domains for the purpose of phishing, the lock can be imposed on them. I'll explain how that works a little bit later. So the motivation comes from our vision, which is probably goes beyond layer 9 and onto sort of cloud 9. But basically, we've got a vision of the internet as a trusted space which has a positive impact on people's lives. You can tell that's engraved on my heart. And what we wanted to do as a result of this is use what influence we have on the domain name space for improving the quality of the experience that people have. And this is probably one of the first things that we've done on this. It's an easy win. Phishing involves domains, and we have control over domains. So it's something that we can easily deploy to make sure that we can take action against these things. What we've done is provide a tool that empowers the registrar to take these down. It can be used by us as well if we're approached by law enforcement agencies, but it's intended to be used primarily by registrars. And what it does is, it like I say, it halts re-registration. So you can't, if your domain has a phishing lock imposed on it, it can't be cancelled. It can't just hop off to somewhere else and reappear again on the internet. Just in case you're aware, these phishing domains tend to look like typos of valid domains. So, I mean, popular UK and I think Portuguese bank, by the looks of it, is Barclays. a phishing domain might be Barclays with the L replaced with a 1, so that it's not immediately obvious that somebody's got this kind of domain. So it is valuable to the people who are doing this. So preventing re-registration reduces the use of that domain. We store our registry in a relational database. It's an Oracle. And we have, as part of any operation that takes place on the database, a what's called a do not allow matrix. Now what this is, it's just a set of views and tables inside the matrix, which allows us to build a matrix of cases against operations. So for phishing, that is a case, and it prevents certain operations to be done on a domain name. So you're unable to cancel the domain name, you're unable to transfer it to another registrant or transfer it away from the registrar that it's on, or you're unable to renew it, so it just holds it in place. If you put the phishing lock on an account, then it qualifies for a different set of operations, and that's it allows the account to create new domain names. It prevents the account from creating new domain names. It prevents them from modifying details on the domain names that they have registered on their tag. So they can't modify the domain names. They can't modify the account details themselves, so they can't make it look like it's somebody else. And this DNA matrix has existed for a good while now. We use it for other operations, such as the account holder has been dissolved of its company or deceased if they're dead, or whether the domain name's been put into our dispute resolution service. So adding this extra check was very simple. It's an easily extendable part of our registration system. So it's had no performance impact. It has no side effects on the other way that we operate. In terms of the way that it's been used, at the moment it's very unused. We've had, in the time I wrote the original slide deck, we've had less than 60 uses in the 5 months that it's been operational. And at the moment, that's running at about 2-1, nominate versus the registrars. We've been the people who've been approached mostly to impose this kind of lock on suspect domains. Looking at the reasons why it's not been used so much, it's probably registrar education largely. People don't realise that this operation's there, or they don't, if they've got a phishing domain on their associated with them, they want to get rid of it quickly, so cancelling's an easier option. There may be something that we have to look at it to do with the charging as well, because at the moment it's free to cancel a domain within a certain amount of time after registration, as opposed to this, which imposing a phishing lock, which will involve you being charged on the domain, but we can review that. We don't have any automated system for checking for abuse. We rely on people making reports to us. We haven't had a recorded instance of abuse yet. By abuse, I mean somebody targeting a legitimate domain and claiming it's used for phishing so that it's taken down by a registrar. We're leaving it up to the registrar to police that kind of activity. So we're pushing the power out to them. If we get some kind of rogue registrar who's imposing phishing locks on legitimate domains for for extortion reasons, presumably, we would we have sanctions to remove their ability to function as a registrar, but remove their right to register domain names and effectively prevent them doing business. When we introduced the phishing lock, we intended it to run for 6 months prior to a review. We also intended it to be used as a tool which would then become part of a news thing that we're bringing on, which is a phishing feed. We're going to be taking a feed from Netcraft, who will produce a list of domain names which are associated with phishing, and we're going to provide that. We'll be able to do a cross-check against the registrar and provide that information to the registrar and say, look, we think this domain's involved in phishing. We would like you to take action about it. But that service itself isn't coming out till probably mid 2010. As part of the review, we're going to obviously review the effectiveness, review any instances of abuse or the review whether there's been an increased potential for abuse. But what we also want to look at is extending it beyond phishing to look at other criminal activity. And one thing that maybe the working group could help is make suggestions about what that kind of activity might be. We've looked at maybe extending it for people who are selling counterfeit tickets or not fulfilling sort of other contractual obligations like that. That's probably going a bit too far, actually. The selling, obviously selling criminal goods is the thing I'm talking about. There has been possible this discussion of hosting of malware, but we've no idea how we would be able to detect that and make it work. But if anybody's got any other ideas, then I'd be glad to hear them. And that's it. Are there any questions?
So, any questions for Ian? Anyone any suggestions of other things that might be used for? No, apparently you made absolutely perfect sense. Thank you very much.
It's been a long day, hasn't it?
Right, back to the exciting agenda. And in fact, I can get to sit straight back down now. The section we have under technical measures has changed a few times over the last couple of days, but the NCC demoed some wonderful tools. I got to see them a couple of weeks ago, and they demoed a few of them earlier in the week. And one of these was Rex, the Resource Explainer. And I asked the NCC to come along and give a presentation here today and a live demo, which Emil has kindly agreed to do, to show just what these tools can do from the point of view of anti-abuse and fighting abuse, because I just really wanted to make the point, because I think they're a fantastic idea. And I think too many people might look at them and go, from registry point of view or whatever else, or checking my own routing or something like that, but I really want to just make the point that these are really useful from that point of view. So if I could ask Emil to do whatever you need to do with your laptop to sort that one out.
And I think we've hopefully got some slightly interesting netblocks to take a look at. I haven't seen what netblocks Emil is going to plug into this.
I have a couple.
I know you have a couple.
If people have more, then...
My point was more that I haven't seen what they are, and we haven't done a who is on them. If they happen to be yours, then such is the luck of the draw, and somebody is doing something wrong in your network somewhere. So nothing to do with 193.1, please. Anyway, I shall sit down again now and let Emil talk about this. Well... once he sorts out. See, we had a conversation in the working group chair's lunch about people using laptops that weren't the presentation laptop. I should have listened. It was NCC staff, actually. Yeah, were particularly mentioned, yeah. Okay.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to demo this tool again with a little more in detail for anti-abuse. So my name is Emil Aben. I work at the RIPE NCC at the Science Group and help develop this tool. So briefly, what is this tool? First of all, it's featured on RIPE Labs, so the URL is here again, and it's probably on the back of some t-shirts in the room as well, so please visit it. So the Resource Explainer is you can find it there, so you can actually, if you want to do live queries right now on whatever prefix you want, feel free. So it, this will give you current and historic information about a resource. And currently, we only do V4, but V6 and autonomous system numbers are also planned. This is a prototype service, so please let us know what you think of it and how we can improve it. One of the next steps we want to do with this is have user type specific views, and one of the interesting views there and very topical for this working group is law enforcement and security. So on to the live demo. Yeah, I thought three times, third time we should get it right.
You should have brought your dog.
Yep. Anytime. Okay.
Actually, if you tried to do wireless, my connection was dropped again. Maybe yours as well.
Oh, okay. I'm just gonna. So who's in favor of more live demos?
If Firefox doesn't start soon, you're doing this through the medium of interpretive dance. You do realize that, don't you?
I was afraid you would ask that. Okay, so I'd preferred, I'd looked at a couple of prefixes, and these are some that I found interesting. For instance, this was one that was associated with the infamous Russian business network. So as you can see, I put the start date a little back, because usually the resource explainer only takes a year of time frame by default. So if you go look up this prefix, and okay, as you can see, currently it is with the planet. This is the routing module of Rex. Currently, the green section is the current section. So the information as current as we have it, this is fairly normal. That, but if you look at the history of this prefix, you can see, and let me get the axis there as well, that sometime in end of 2007, a couple of more specifics were being announced by several autonomous systems, and then everything stopped. Then you see a large gap, and then you see it being announced again by another a prefix, by another autonomous system. And this AS number, this is actually the AS number that the Russian business network used. So you can, with this interface, you can correlate that information with what happened in blacklists. So currently, the planet is apparently doing a good job of keeping their stuff clean, and for the lists that we have in the current prototype of this tool, this looks very clean. But if you look at the history, you see that there's two resources from this /20 in the drop, the do not route or peer list by Spamhaus. And you can actually look what the prefixes are. You can sort of dig into the details of these. And below you can see the number of entries in a specific blacklist and the coverage. And because one wasn't more specific of the other, that first block is actually 100%. And you can also correlate to geolocation information. So right now, most of it is in the UK. It's got a little bit of stuff everywhere. But if you look at the history, you see something interesting, I think. But in the end of 2008, this block was still geolocated according to the MaxMind database, partly in Russia, which is the green, partially in Panama, which is the blue, and partially on the Seychelles Islands. So that's here you sort of get a feel for what a block is really being used for by just combining information from various sources. And then there's a gap, and then you have it all in the UK. And actually, if you look at the last one up here, you see that there's a little use in different countries as well. And we, of course, these geolocation databases are not 100% accurate, but it gives you a sense of the block, of its cleanliness. So another example is, I just picked an entry from the Spamhaus drop list. So again, in the routing module here, you can see a little bit of what it currently is and routing history. Nothing spectacular here. But if you go to the blacklist section, you can see that the UC Protect Level 1 list actually has two resources listed currently. The drop doesn't have this listed anymore, and again you can see the details. And for the history, you can sort of see what's happening here. So this UC Protect list found a little bit of activity. So it was put in this list, and then apparently it was put in the drop list at some point, and taken out again. But if you look at the coverage, so the drop covers the full prefix that I put in, the /22, whereas UC Protect only has /32, so specific IP addresses. So with these two graphs, you can actually see the difference on information like that. And the third one I wanted to show is one that I picked out of a list of command and control servers that's associated with Zeus, which is a CRIMER kit. So if we do that query there again, apparently this is currently not routed. But it has been routed by this particular autonomous system, and you can actually see where it stopped about, somewhere 2007, 2009. And it was part of a /23, so if you go to that /23, you can actually see that was also, again, in the drop list, and still is, apparently. So Okay, that's it for the live demo. Now to the safer stuff, hopefully. Okay, these examples were based on data that we currently have in our backend data store, which is called INRDB. So for the spam list I showed, we only started tracking some data earlier this year, and it's especially true for the UC Protect list that we only started tracking in June. And we found some historic information about the spam house drop list, so we have information going a little bit back further. So if people know or would like us to include any useful data, anything that is, has sort of a time component and a resource component in there, then please let us know how we can make this tool better and how we can make this tool better fit the needs of the NTBUs community. So one possible issue there is licensing. Of course, we're working with databases that where stuff like that might be an issue. So if you have any suggestions on things like that, or have any suggestions on how we should improve this resource explainer prototype, please let us know. Speak up here, or talk to me, or talk to anybody else in the science group or in the NCC, or put your comments on Ripe Labs, of course. So that's it for me. Thank you for listening. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? No more questions? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Shane Kerr. I just have a question. Have you had anyone approach you with concerns that you may be making them look bad by publishing all this in an easy to get to format?
Sorry.
Well, if I have a network, I may not want my customers to know that I have lots of blacklisted entries in it, for example.
We haven't had somebody approach us yet, but thing is, this is all publicly available data anyways, so...
Yes.
So but we just
between,
make it easy.
I mean, that's like saying the DNS is public, so I can do whatever I want in it, which is not strictly true. So anyway, I will discuss this with you over drinks tonight, perhaps.
Okay, sure.
Well, I mean, on that point, I can imagine that people may not, which from my point of view is a terrible pity for them.
I agree. It's just because it's an NCC activity. If I was an LIR who was getting bad information published about me, I might be a little bit annoyed.
So for us, it's also sort of.
I'm not saying don't do it. I'm glad you're doing it. I just was curious if it's happening.
And this is exactly why it's on Ripe Labs, because it's a prototype. we could get. All kinds of technical questions on this, any other kind of question on it, and so this is not a production service. If there are serious issues like that, we can take it down.
Okay.
We don't intend to, but we could.
That's fair.
Well, thank you very much, Emil.
I mean, I, for one, looking at it, especially considering some conversations which have already taken place this week about the purchase of address space and about temporary address space assignments that took place in address policy there just before, just after lunch indeed. You know those car sites where you can type in the car registration to see if the car has been written off or the car has been whatever else? Ta-da! Same thing for NetBlocks. Certainly, if we get to a point where people are obviously purchasing or trading or whatever else NetBlocks, or they're taking temporary assignments, then here's a very simple tool of figuring out what your potential NetBlock has been up to for the last while, which admittedly may also cause the same problems that Shane is talking about, because the seller may not want you to know. But I think it's a very lovely way of going caveat emptor, and this is how you find out. So. We have a few other things I'd like to discuss under the heading of interactions. The first one is the one I've actually listed there, which is the database working group and IRT objects. There was some conversation on the mailing list and in other mails about the matter of abuse contacts and abuse contacts in IRT objects, and was what I was touching on earlier. And Vilfried in address policy, sorry, in address policy, in database, said that anti-abuse hadn't discussed it yet. And at that point in time, I mentioned that from my point of view, there wasn't a lot for us to discuss in anti-abuse. The last conversation I had with the person who was raising this was that they said, well, the abuse contact is there, it's mandatory, and we're recommending, you know, and obviously we're also recommending in general that people provide accurate abuse contact details. And the person who raised that point seemed happy enough with that. As so we were kind of going, well, that's what's there. So we don't see any further action on anti-abuse or indeed on database that's been raised to do anything with that. So unless anyone in the room thinks I'm horribly wrong, I'm quite content to kind of close off this action point and inform database officially that we have done so. I would cynically say until the next time somebody raises it on the mailing list, but hopefully not. So unless there's anything else there. Okay, and I see Wilfried nodding, so I'm happy enough with that. The other sort of interaction which was touched on by Axel in the NC Services Working Group yesterday, which I neglected to add into my latest version of the agenda, was touching on the point of, which I then have listed under D4, but I'm gonna go to straight now, was under the point of registry closures. Now, there was some conversation in NC Services yesterday about it, and Axel again outlined the reasons that the NCC could close a registry, which basically comes down to, and Joachim can jump up and tell me if I'm wrong here, but basically comes down to them not paying or them ceasing to exist and therefore not paying. A number of people have mentioned in conversations at various times how it would be just wonderful if there was a big button that someone could press and said, you no longer exist, you can no longer do anything, we revoke your resources, we revoke your certificate if such a thing comes to pass or otherwise. But there was a lot of conversation in NCC Services yesterday about how, well, A, we don't particularly want anyone to have a big button which can switch off the internet, and B, even if we did, it wouldn't work. That while people still reroute resources to a certain extent, it's not that it doesn't matter what RIPE NCC say about them, because obviously a lot of people listen to them, but there's nothing that we can actually do to stop people routing resources or stop people advertising. So we've been trying to explain this to a large number of groups of people, and this comes under some of the law enforcement interaction as well. And I suppose the point of raising it here is to mention that this conversation has been ongoing, and to ask the room if anyone has any kind of comments on that whole aspect, if there is anyone here who would like to raise and would like to turn around again and say, RIPE NCC, why can't you do something about these net blocks or, you know, or ASs or otherwise? I suppose also to ask, is the message clear enough that at the moment they're the tools that the NCC has? The other point which Axel, of course, was raising and which was mentioned is that if the community wanted the NCC to attempt to do anything more, whether it would be useful or not useful, then obviously the policy would have to be raised by the community. And it was clearly identified that anti-abuse was one of the working groups through which that policy was most likely to be raised. And I saw some sort of confirming that, just in case anyone in the room has been sitting there going, I wonder which working group I go to talk to about having my, you know, my next door neighbor shut down. So I don't know if there's any comment that anyone wants to add to that, but I just kind of wanted to raise it, say it's there, And we're talking about it, and I'll touch on more of that under D2 and D3 now in a second. Excellent, resounding silence. Not excellent, obviously. I'd like lots of people to talk, but possibly not for hours. So this does tie in with D2 and D3, the law enforcement interaction, and indeed the LAP CSNA. Now, this is the point where I've completely forgotten what CSNA stands for, but LAP is the London Action Plan, and they are having a joint workshop with the CSNA, which would be really useful if anyone could remind me what it stands for, but I have it on my laptop, in Lisbon this week. So we've been having conversations with a bunch of people. Law enforcement, we had a roundtable meeting as an adjunct to the global roundtable meeting, which took place 2 weeks ago. My time sense is kind of fuzzy. Two weeks ago or so in Schiphol. And myself, the NCC staff, including Joachim and Axel, and a number of other representatives of the community, including Wilfried and Nigel Titley and David Friedman, sat down with a number of representatives of law enforcement agencies, including the Dutch police, Dutch Ministry of Justice, the serious organized crime people from the UK, was represented from the FBI, and a few other representatives there as well. Now there's bits of this meeting, makes it sound terribly special and all secret agency that we can't discuss, or you know, we'd have to kill you all or something like that. It would all get very messy. But the main thrust of the meeting, and indeed the main thrust of what we're going to go and talk to the London Action Plan about tomorrow, is to tell all of these people that the RIPE community and the RIPE NCC exist. And I'm specifically talking from the point of view of the RIPE community, and what we do and how we do things. As was said in NC Services, it's not like we're aware of all these problems and all these law enforcement people and people like that talking about the internet and doing nothing about it. We're doing an awful lot about it. And we'll be going and telling them, this is how you make policy. You're more than welcome. You're part of the RIPE community as well. And while we don't necessarily expect law enforcement to turn up en masse to working group sessions or otherwise, a number of representatives have come in the past, and we're making it very clear what the avenues are, and that even if the way they communicate with us is through me or through the NCC, then there are those avenues of communication into the RIPE community. We are friendly, open arms, very welcoming, that we have technical knowledge and technical experience that they may not have, and we are more than willing to share all of it with them, and all they have to do is ask, and that we are not unaware of their requirements and their needs. Now, equally, nor are we saying, fantastic, we'll do whatever you want, because that obviously isn't the way we act, and we're not suddenly changing our procedures to be however they would like to act. So it's very much a case of meeting them in the middle and making sure, to a certain extent, as Marco said, making sure that we're informing the people who are making decisions on a national and international level, and making sure that RIPE community plays a very large part in that, and a very active part in that. Obviously, what we say to them is informed by yourselves. So if there are any points that you feel that it would be useful to carry forth from the Anti-Abuse Working Group into any of the conversations we have with such groups, then you can obviously talk to myself at any point, my co-chair, or indeed people like Joachim in the NCC, or you can raise the points now or on the mailing list. I think it's very important to be aware that communication is ongoing and will continue to be ongoing. And I've got to say right now that it's through the good offices of the people in the NCC that we've had the opportunity to speak to these people, because it's not normally the case that I'm in a room with a lot of people in suits who have powers of arrest, thankfully. There isn't really very much of a specific point here, kind of a question to ask, but are there any comments that anyone would like to make? Are there any groups which people think that we should be engaging with that you think we aren't? Are there any people in the room that we're not engaging with in a proper fashion, that you think would be really useful to talk to? Yeah.
you all feel appropriately engaged with. Excellent. The last actual full point I have on my agenda here is, that should be documentation. Anyway, the BCP documentation. We stated very clearly that we were going to, in Amsterdam, that we were going to update 409. A small group was formed to do that. It hasn't done it yet. I will quite happily hold my hand up, well, not happily, but regretfully hold my hand up and say that's my fault. The job that pays my daily wages got an awful lot more demanding over the last 6 months. So we didn't have the time to do it. I am very, very much hoping that we will have a draft document of the updated BCP to reflect the widening of the charter in Prague. That's what I'm really hoping to say now. We have, there's only five or six people there, but there's a lot of knowledge and experience, so we're hoping we can present that to you shortly before the Prague meeting to give you all enough time to read it and then hopefully not tear it to pieces in the working group session. And the IRT abuse, obviously object abuse contact recommendations and requirements will be clearly included in that document to reflect what the community has asked us to do. So, AOB. Doesn't appear to be any. So I'm going to move on past that and say that, so we'll be looking for an agenda for RIPE 60. Sadly, a number of people had to pull out of this agenda, the media working group meeting today at the last minute, so I'm hoping a number of them will come back. But obviously, I'd like to kind of take the flavor of things we've had here today, such as, you know, some things which the speakers maybe didn't initially think would be interesting to the anti-abuse working group, and I'd clearly like to show are. So if you've any similar projects or otherwise which you think might be of interest for us in May in Prague, that would be wonderful. And obviously, if there's anything which would sit better in the EOF, in the plenary, rather than in the working group, then, well, there's space for that as well. So I think that's largely that. I think that it's 5:15 now, which seems very appropriate. The buses start leaving for the RIPE dinner, I think it's around 7, although all the information is on Rosie. They are leaving from the terrace at the back. So those of you who are going to the dinner, you have that amount of time to freshen up or indeed start drinking. And I think that's done for me. So thank you all very much, and we will see you at RIPE 60 in Prague.